Today's reading is from Genesis. Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the first fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer. That was what our communications director, Patty Kay, suggested I should entitle this sermon when she heard I was preaching Cain and Abel. She did not know that I was Curly in my high school production of Oklahoma. I could sing the whole song if you wanted me to. There is a VHS tape somewhere in a box in my attic that I must find and destroy before my kids see it someday. But isn't it interesting, just interesting, that the conflict which is described in this ancient text between the tiller of the ground and the keeper of herds continues, you know, all throughout history, even up until relatively modern times. I mean, this passage is archetypal, it's ancient, it speaks to a conflict which is deeply rooted in us as human beings. But the conflict isn't just about agriculture. It's not even about culture. It's more deeply about worship and about the conflict that happens whenever people worship in different ways. I was drawn to this passage, about 6 weeks ago. Mark Squire, our director of music, gave me a book called Exploring the Worship Spectrum. And it's an interesting book because it's written by six different authors, all of whom represent different styles or modes of worship within American Christianity today. I mean, a couple authors speak on the liturgical and traditional side, and others speak from the charismatic and contemporary and emergent worship side. And what's interesting is each author writes one chapter kind of explaining the heart, the intent behind the style of worship which they lead. And then the other five authors get a few pages to write responses and rebuttals to that author. And so it's kind of set up in debate. These authors are all noted worship leaders and scholars, men and women of God, and they treat each other with the utmost respect, and they all acknowledge that the real aim of worship is to praise God, right? But even saying all that, they can't resist the temptation every once in a while to offer a criticism or critique of the other styles of worship. And by the same token, they also can't resist the need to defend themselves and their style of worship from others. I mean, it's wired into us how personal and worship is, that we need it to defend it. Anyways, the editor of this book, Paul Bardsden, the one who invited all these authors to speak, he sets it up in the introduction. He says, you know, what you're going to find in the pages which follow is a reflection of the worship wars which are taking place in churches in America across the country, especially within churches like ours, that are transitioning from one dominant mode of worship into a multiplicity of languages. He used that phrase, worship wars. And I thought, wow, that's where we've been the last 12 plus months. And as I thought about that phrase, worship wars, I went back to Cain and Abel and thought, this is the first worship war and the history of mankind, at least documented. Before I say what's about war, and claiming this passage is about worship wars is to say that its first and primary thing is what it has to teach us about worship itself. Here's what it has to say about worship. It tells us that the first impulse, the heart of worship for humankind is to make it an offering. I mean, this is the first description of worship in the Bible. Adam and Eve certainly walked with God, communed with God, but you get the sense that their fellowship with God is so close that they don't actually engage or design any worship. This is it. This is the first time. And the instinct that Cain and Abel have is to make an offering before God. And not just any offering, a specific kind of offering. This isn't an offering of forgiveness to placate an angry God. They haven't sinned yet. And this isn't a manipulative offering, you know, to seek God's blessing for the harvest that is to come. No, the harvest is already complete. The animals have been raised. This is an offering of thanksgiving for the good things they've already received. This is an offering. What they bring to the table, it represents an extension of themselves, the very best of who they are and what they do and what they live for, and they're bringing it and laying it before God and asking for God's approval and validation. That's what worship is. It's offering. I mean, when we come to worship, it's all offering, not just when we pass the plates back and forth, but the music, it's an offering to God. The prayers, they're an offering. Even the sermon, it's an offering to God in your attentive listening. When we come, we bring our hearts and we lay them before God and we seek inspiration and reflection and replenishment so that we can go out and make the next 6 days or 2 weeks or month an even better offering. See, this 1 hour reorients our lives because it says that everything that has happened up until this point and everything that's going to happen and everything in between, we're laying it before God and making it an offering to Him. You with me? And if we agree with that worship is about offering, then it reorients us because it's not anymore about us, it's about God. It's for God. So we have to evaluate worship differently. We all have this tendency to evaluate worship self-referentially. Did it please me? Did I like the music? Did I like the sermon? Did it challenge me, comfort me, inspire me? And for those of us in leadership, we tend to evaluate, you know, was there a good feeling in the room? Was there warmth? Were there bodies in the pews or were the seats empty? You know, how did it go? But if we get it right, we realize that all those questions are secondary. It doesn't matter if worship pleases us. The primary question is whether the worship we bring this day, this hour, is pleasing to God. Now, just to say that we come laying it before God, that it's for God, doesn't mean that we don't seek something in return. Cain and Abel, when they laid that offering before God, what were they seeking? They were seeking approval, affirmation, validation. They wanted something in return, and Cain didn't get it, did he? Now, that's one of those deep, deep, deep theological questions. One that I have never really been able to answer. Why did God not accept Cain's offering? Some scholars, they think, well, it has to do with, you know, in this text, we see archetypes that Cain and Abel aren't just people. They are representatives of two different cultures, and we see the preference for the nomadic shepherding culture that meat has more value than grain. And maybe that's true, but the reality also is that in the Israelite law, grain offerings were acceptable. If that's the best you could bring to the table, they would be good enough. So technically, Abel's offering should have been accepted. Some say, well, it's not the gift itself. The gift itself was fine. It was the heart behind the gift. That God could peer into Cain and Abel's hearts, and he could see what was in Cain's heart, and therefore the gift was rejected. And again, maybe so. But the way I read the text, Cain didn't have an ugly heart. until his offering was rejected. I mean, there's nothing in the text that suggests that he came to the offering, to the worship, with any less sincerity and humbleness of spirit than his brother Abel. So I can't answer the question. All I can do is speak to the reality that Cain didn't get what he was expecting. We were talking about this in our kind of worship planning session. I told Rob what I was going to be preaching about, and he said, "You ever thought about this? What would have happened if Cain didn't have a brother? I mean, would he have been aware of, would he have noticed that his offering wasn't as good as? Is it part of the problem, the comparison of the two?" And I thought, yeah, that's what happens. It's in the comparison that some of the rub takes place. And I thought about here at St. Luke's. Up until a month ago, we had one dominant style of worship on Sunday mornings. And a lot of the angst and pressure and hurt of the last year has taken place because now we have two, and there is a comparison and a contrast which naturally happens. In fact, if you were to take this same passage and you were to rip out the names Cain and Abel and you were to drop in contemporary worship and traditional worship, yeah, try it, read it through. And it is like an apt description of what's been happening in our church the last 14 months. And the only reason I don't do that, I caution you not to do it maybe, is because who do you put in the place of Cain? And who do you put in the place of Abel? Does God prefer one style of worship over another? I don't believe so. I believe it's all acceptable and good to God. But that doesn't mean there's not preference. We experience both a personal preference and a cultural preference, right? And when our personal preference lines up with cultural preference, oh man, that's great, it's easy, it's good. What happens is when our personal preference, what we value, what speaks to us, starts going up against a change in the dominant culture, it sets us up for disregard. That's the sentence that, as I kept reading and rereading this passage, kind of stuck out, that for Cain and his offering, the Lord had no regard. And I thought to myself, that's where the wound is dealt. Regard. I mean, as I've talked with people who have been displaced by the change in worship styles, it's not just that they're being asked to worship at a different hour or a different place. It's not that. It's the feeling of being disregarded, not counting, that my offering, what I bring to the table, the style of worship that I value deeply, that it's not counted in the same way as those who are younger or newer or whatever. There's disregard, and that hurts. And the disregard goes the opposite way too, because there are those who work within the contemporary worship service who enjoy going there, and the band that tries to bring the best they have every week, and yet that goes against the dominant culture of St. Luke's. And sometimes they hear the criticism and they feel disregarded. There's a mutual feeling of hurt, a wound that exists within our church. And then underneath that, there's this well of anger. That's what happens when you're not regarded. Cain is angry, and his countenance is fallen. See, I started off thinking this passage was about worship. I lived with that for a couple weeks. And then I thought, no, it's about comparison. And I lived with that a couple weeks. And then finally, this last week, it dawned on me, it's about anger. And that's what's going on in our church, too. That I hear it, I see it, I feel it. And no sermon can change it. No words are good enough. No rationale of our vision. I mean, they just get consumed up in the fire of our fury. And my desire, my heartfelt desire as a pastor, is for healing. For those who are hurt to be healed, for our congregation as a whole, for the split, for that wound to be knitted over and healed, but we can't do it unless we acknowledge it, unless we deal with the anger that's underneath. And this is where it broadens out, that you may not have been part of these worship wars the last 12, 14 months, but that doesn't mean that you don't come here struggling somewhat with anger. Anger can exist behind a smile, you know. And there can be lots of sources of anger and dissatisfaction in life. It might be work, that boss you have to deal with. It might be home, that your relationship with your spouse or with your brother or your sister or your parents or your kids isn't working out the way you intended. I mean, there's so many sources that anger can enter into our lives. What do we do with it when it's there? Cain is angry. And God sees it, and he goes to him, and he empathizes. He says, I see your anger. Why is your countenance fallen? And he cautions him. He says, sin is lurking at the door. This is the first time in the Bible we ever see the word sin. That doesn't mean it didn't happen a chapter before with Adam and Eve, but this is the first time the word is used. And God says to Cain, it's lurking at your door, just the way the serpent was lurking in wait for Eve, crouching, and its desire is for you. And God implores with Cain and with us, you must master it. But of course, Cain can't, doesn't. Instead, it consumes him so much that when he's alone with his brother in the field, he strikes him. And when the God comes to him, asking where Abel is, Cain denies and says, am I my brother's keeper? So let me ask you this. Does your healing depend on getting what you want? Getting it just the way you want it to be? If it does, then you're stuck. We are stuck. We'll keep playing out this drama of Cain and Abel again and again and again and again, because that's what Cain wants. It doesn't satisfy him that God pays personal attention to him, that God goes and seeks him out, that God gives him warning. That doesn't satisfy him. You get the picture that nothing is enough for Cain unless God reverses the whole thing and says, you know what, I was wrong, your offering, I forgot, it does look good, I'll take it back, sorry. That's the only thing that's going to satisfy Cain. But God points to another direction. He says, if you do not do well, if you do well, will you not be accepted? Commentators say it's like God's opening another path. He's saying there's another offering you can make right now, today, and if you make it, you'll be accepted. So what's the second offering? Is God saying to Cain, go get a sheep and kill it and bring it to me? No. I think the offering that Cain was asked to make is the offering of his anger. I think Cain had to let go of his frustration, his feelings toward God, his need to be right, his need to be justified. He had to let that go. And that would have been his healing. And I think we are asked to make the same offering as well. I mean, that we have to bring to this altar our frustrations, our need to be right, the debts that we feel people owe us. And we have to let go of that because it's corrosive to our spirit, and God's healing can't enter until we let it go. That's the sacrifice God calls us to make. You see, once I realized this passage was about anger, I realized I knew something about anger. I didn't used to. I used to tell people, I once told my therapist that I don't feel anger. I don't deal with it. I don't struggle with it. I don't even feel it, which of course was a major red flag for her. But I really felt that way. I had a friend who was a pastor who struggled with anger, and he told me, you know, I just want to bite the head off of everyone in my church. And I remember looking at him and thinking, what's wrong with you, you know? And then 3-4 years later, I lived into it. About 18 to 12 months ago, I was so angry I couldn't see straight. And I didn't like being angry, and I tried to suppress it and hide it behind a smile. I mean, I don't even know what I was angry about. Was I angry at the church? Was I angry at family? Was I angry? I was just dissatisfied, unhappy. And because of that, I was angry. I wrote in my journal one day, I said, it's like there's this well of anger that is just beneath the surface. And it doesn't take much these days to access it. And normally the people who were accessing it most frequently were my family, the people who live closest to me. I mean, it would just happen without even wanting me to. I'd sit down with the kids to do something fun and positive like Legos or, which is exercises in patience with kids, or homework, or just, you know, watching TV. And if the kids fought at all, I mean, it just would just well up so fast. And my kids would say to me, Daddy, are you angry? And I'd instantly say, no, I'm fine, it's okay. And they'd say, well, you got your angry face on. It all came to a head Margaret's birthday last year, which happened to fall on Good Friday. And Good Friday, you know, is a busy season for us as pastors. But we'd been busy for a long time. We made the mistake of overscheduling our kids like a lot of parents with good intentions do, and every night there was something to go to, and I was worn out. That part of that schedule was feeding into the anger, I think. Any rate, Margaret's birthday, Good Friday. We looked at the church calendar, and we looked at Margaret's calendar, and we realized there was no way to celebrate, have a party for at least a couple weeks, so we thought, well, we'll just do it when we get home on Good Friday. And so we got home after services, it was close to 9 o'clock, and we started the party, which is too late. The kids need to be heading towards bed, but we were determined. I was determined I needed this party, you know? But the kids started arguing, I think, about who got to blow out the candles, and Nathan blew them out even though it wasn't his birthday, and that upset Margaret. I mean, normally Margaret just has a lot of bounce with those kinds of things. She can roll with it, but she was tired and overstretched, and so she just started crying. And I was so furious. I mean, furious. And I didn't blow up. That's not the way I express anger, but my displeasure was over everything. And I went upstairs because I just had to get away. I didn't want to ruin the party. And I listened as downstairs, Jamelyn kind of put everyone back together and they sang happy birthday again. And I'm just upstairs fuming and I can't let it go. And I wrote this, Easter Sunday, this well of anger. I can say things are better now, lots better. And I'm not sharing this so that you take sympathy for me. I'm sharing it because it did get better. I mean, so much so that 6 months later, I went back and I read this in my journal, and I hardly could connect to this person who was so angry. And I went to Jamelyn and I said, was I just being overdramatic in my journal? Was I just blowing it up? And she said, no, you weren't. You were miserable. but things are better now. But I don't know exactly how they got better. It didn't happen overnight. And it wasn't just external things changing. A lot of it was changing inside. But these are two things that I knew I had to decide. The first was I had to stop blaming other people for my unhappiness. It wasn't their fault, it was mine. Only I can own my own unhappiness, only I can do something about it. That was the first thing. And then the second thing was this desire, this impulse to make my life a better offering to God. And I was trying to make it an offering. I was doing everything I knew how, but I needed God's help to make it a better offering because I didn't want to give to God this burned out, crisped over, yucky offering that I was giving. I wanted my heart and my life and my ministry to be joyful and loving, for it to be the kind of offering that God would take pleasure in. I needed God's help to make it a better offering. And I share this journey with you because that's what Lent is about. And we're going into the season of Lent, and we always talk about giving something up, giving up chocolate, giving up carbs, giving up whatever. But the stuff that God really wants us to give up and lay down is the stuff that's corrosive to our souls. Whether it's anger, or whether it's, you know, some sin, lust, or apathy, or depression, or hurt. I mean, I said the word depression, I got me in tricky water with a therapist sitting right in front of me. But all I'm saying about that sadness, even an unhappiness, is we have to bring that stuff to God. We have to lay it at God's feet, and we have to ask for God's help and grace to let it go and to transform our lives. Grace is not easy. It's free. Free for everyone. We don't have to earn God's love. It's freely given to us, but it will cost us everything. It will cost us most of all our self-righteousness, our need to be superior, our entitlements, the debts and hurts we hold on to. We got to lay that down. It'll cost us that for us to experience the healing and love that God offers us. So I ask you, what offering is God asking you to make this morning? What do you need to leave here at the altar today? Will you pray with me? Oh God, our desire is for healing inside and out. We need your help to get there. We want our hearts to be healed, but even more so, we want our community to be healed. For this to be a place where your grace is known and celebrated and loved and shared across boundaries, across worship styles, for us to support and care for one another, we need your help to get there. So whatever we're holding on to today, may your Spirit pry back our fingers that we might release it into your grace and your love, that it might dissolve and in its place we might have joy. This we pray in your Son's holy name.